testing? Okay, good. Just so we can kind of get that in on the online broadcast, or actually more online than are here. Okay, Christendom. We pretty much cracked that, not in the last study. So we're going to fold in a lot of thoughts that have already happened on all of the studies, World of Mankind, Church, Great Multitude, even Israel to a certain extent.
This is Brother Rick's job.
Yeah, I know. But we're going in a processional. I'm going to steal your job, Brother Rick, so the last man is going to have to come up with his own material. Christendom. We're going to try to nail down, you know, be a little more specific with the terms that we use, because as Bible students, we often apply specific terms to just wide swaths that we don't always have, I'll say, the authority to do that. For instance, oftentimes we'll use the word Babylon. We'll say Babylon this, Babylon that. And we're talking about everything. We're not talking about Babylon the Great, mother of harlots. We're talking about the nominal systems, as we like to say, in general. First things first, and this is really going to... I'm actually going to shut this off for a minute. Because it's right in my eyes. Is there anyone here who has not read the second volume, specifically the Man of Sin chapter? Okay. Because that's really a prerequisite understanding. We're not going to go into the definitions on a lot of things, but we do want to be very specific. Even Christendom, to a certain extent, is a little bit of a misnomer, because the idea of Christ's kingdom comes from where? Where does the term Christendom originate from? Anyone? Sister Rachel. Oh, wait, no, Sister Marge.
It's a combination of Christ's kingdom.
Okay. And who, I mean, where did, is it something we came up with?
It's a counterfeit. I think Satan came up with it, but in any case, as human instrumentalities came up with it, because they were trying to establish Christ's thousand-year kingdom on earth in their own time, which was considerably ahead of the Lord's time.
Okay. While it wasn't a conscious effort, I'll say, by them saying, okay, Christ's kingdom says it's going to be 1,000 years here on earth, we're going to go ahead and proceed with that on our own, it was in a de facto sense. Because when they melded, you know, the word Christendom has existed almost as long as the English language has existed. When they melded church and state, all the way back with who? What specific event solidified the church-state in reality, the church-state union? Sister Karen?
Was it Pepin or Charlemagne?
Pepin, Charlemagne. That's right. When he, you know, was crowned by the Pope. We can trace, you know, things back further than that. But as far as definitive answers... again, Christendom is Christ's kingdom in the false sense, like Sister Marge said. What happened in 1914 that really shook up this whole idea or concept of Christendom? Sister Rachel, and then Sister...
Well, I'd say the kings had had their day.
Okay.
You had 10 kings, 10 crowns and 10 kings, and they lost it in 1914 or the First World War.
Okay. I think you're referring perhaps to, I think Sister Sherrell had her hand up. Go ahead, Sister Sherrell.
I was going to say that it was the end of the concept of the divine right of kings.
Okay. By and large, there are, you know, there are still certain exceptions, but as a whole, that's true. Brother Allen.
Well, two things. Number one, it was two parts of Christ's kingdom fighting against each other, and so that kind of blows a hole in that theory. But I do believe that...
Okay, say that again? That was really quick. I mean, you like one auctioneer on me for a second.
Two parts of Christendom were fighting against each other and killing each other by the millions, and that kind of blew a hole in the concept of this being Christ's kingdom. Okay. That's one thing, maybe the most important. But as a constitutional element, the divine right of kings was removed from all the constitutions of Europe during World War I. I don't think there's any constitution that still retains that.
In Europe, correct.
I don't know if
which
any
is,
other...
No, that's fine. I mean, okay, that's true. First, let's ask another question. Why is this... You know, look at the subjects we just had. Church, world, great multitude, Christendom. You know, church, world, great multitude, those ostensibly are comprised of individuals, and ultimately they all get life on one plane or another. What happens to Christendom? Sister Bernice.
It's destroyed.
Okay, say it again.
It's destroyed.
It's destroyed. When does it come back? Sister Bernice.
Never.
Okay, never. I mean, really, it's going to be annihilated, destroyed, never to be seen again. You know, no vestige of it will remain. There will be absolutely no power, nothing in Christendom once it is ultimately destroyed. Where is it destroyed in the Bible? What's that?
Millstone,
okay. Where in the Bible? Give me a... Just, I mean, I'm like trying to coyly bring in everything Brother Allen went through, but... Sister Sherelle.
Well, symbolically with the destruction of Babylon, so Revelation 18, Jeremiah 51.
Okay. Revelation, Jeremiah, a whole number of other types and pictures, and Jezebel being killed, you know, the actual city of Babylon being taken, Jerusalem being destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar. I mean, just picture after picture after picture. Why do we care? I mean, why do we have Christendom as one of our topics for this weekend? Sister Karen.
Because it affects the church, the great company, and the civil, which affects the church and the great company. It all is part of what everything.
Okay. It's inextricably linked. It's intertwined with absolutely every spirit-begotten class, with the world of mankind. It affects us instrumentally, and by us being able to... We all know, again, everyone's... No one raised their hand that they hadn't read the second volume and aren't familiar with the Man of Sin chapter. We all know what's going down. But, you know, we don't walk up to some guy coming out of his church and say, "Hey, pal, do you know you're going down, boy?" We don't do that kind of stuff. It's, you know, it's like an internal. We don't go out. We don't witness to people, by the way. Some denominations do. You know, did you know that your church is going to be destroyed? You know, come out now. Sister Bernice, go ahead.
It's also the fault. False system which belongs to Satan. He's going to be destroyed, so will his system, never to be resurrected again.
All right. This is a prophetic study weekend, slash what it was called at one point, well, we won't even go into that, but future events. The whole idea for us coming here, meeting, is not to rehash a lot of what happened in the past, because that will take up a tremendous amount of time. The assumption is we're already familiar with that. We've done the reading. We've listened to various discourses. We know the scriptures. It's what happens from now, this point forward, with Christendom. You know, Christendom's a huge term. It's a broad term. If essentially it ended circa 1914, how is it that we have anything on our radar as far as a future fulfillment of prophecy at the hand of Christendom? There's not necessarily a specific answer to that question, but why are we studying Christendom if it's essentially a thing of the past? Anybody? Sister Marge.
Well, it's still existing today, not in its former power, but what's left of it is still there, and it definitely does affect the life of the Lord's people. It has an effect on Israel. It has effect on the great company, as well as the little flock, and so it is intertwined in that sense. And okay. It's a persecutor of those who are God's people.
Has it done much in the way of persecution in the last... We're 2013. I mean, can you believe that? How many brethren here who consecrated who knows when thought we'd be having these meetings in 2013? I think, you know, when I consecrated, which really wasn't all that long ago, and I'm thinking the 1994 date was rattling around, and I'm like, yeah, let's get this done. You know, it's a couple more years. I can last that long. So anyway, 2013... 1914, World War I. So we're literally 100 years, 99 if you want to be specific, into the future. We are 97 years past when the pastor went on to his reward, October 1916. And we're still discussing the things that he wrote all that time ago. Sister Robin, go ahead.
I just have a question. I guess how are we really defining Christendom? Are we saying it's the church's power to give power to the civil, to the kings? Is it the church-state union? Is it? I guess I'm getting fuzzy on the definition.
Okay, Brother Rick.
Well, this and along with that, most think of Christ, of Christendom as nations that claim to be Christ's kingdom, and we think those nations don't make that claim any longer. So in my mind, the scriptural account that there's going to be a church and state confederacy in the future, according to Revelation 17 and 18 and other places, in my mind, I still use the term Christendom in a rather loose sense, but I think in my mind, we still have Christian denominations that believe they have a right to civil authority, whether directly, like the papacy, or rather indirectly, evangelicals voting in Christian government. So they think the United States, for example, should be ruled by a Christian government. And in fact, with the rise of immorality and these other things, what happens is that it puts denominations like the evangelical Protestants in harmony with the Roman Catholics on a number of these social issues. So they're both thinking in their own way that there should be a Christian government in control. So in my mind, that's the kind of adjustment I've made to the so-called divine rights of kings, which end with the monarchies, yet there's Christian leaders still teaching that our government, kings, should be ruling according to divine authority.
Okay. Sort of, I guess, you know, as far as definitions go, Brother Russ. Let's...
So I don't even know where these comments fit in, really. But well, first of all, just by way of a general dictionary definition these days, the part of the world in which Christianity prevails.
Okay.
So that's how it's, I'll say, commonly understood today. Why are, I think you had the question to the effect, why are we still concerned about studying it or something to that effect?
In this specific setting.
Okay.
It's
okay. Well, then I'd say Revelation 17, 10 through 12, you know, the 10 horns receiving power as 1 hour with the beast. In other words, persecuting power.
Okay.
Not the 1260 years of persecuting power, but an hour of power in which we would expect, if we're faithful, that's where we will reach our demise.
Yeah, that's the direction, you know, we want to sail in as far as the thinking of an hour. First, Sister Diane, then, well, it's their hand up aside from Brother Allen. Brother Allen.
Actually, it's a question and a comment. I think the question first is if we're thinking in that Christendom as a definition is the same as talking about Babylon. Because if we're talking about Babylon, then we know from the parable of the wheat and the tares that they were allowed to grow together throughout the gospel age, but ultimately during the harvest there was a separation period. And in Jeremiah, the 51st chapter, the 7th verse, it says, Babylon hath been a golden cup in the Lord's hand that made all the earth drunken. The nations have drunken of her wine, therefore the nations are mad. So all through history we have that experience of Babylon and i.e. Christendom during that time that were permitted to have control over Christianity. And it wasn't until they were thrown off in 1881 that that whole experience now is changed.
Okay. All right. Brother Al.
Okay. You know, we can be technical or we can be practical when we're looking at definitions.
Practical.
And I appreciated what Brother Russ read because I think it was practical. And I think we all recognize Christendom exists or we wouldn't be talking about it. But we're looking at it in that kind of broad sense. Though I do see a distinction between, well, let me put it differently. I see that something important happened in 1914.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think we can ignore that. And to focus on the future, what I understand is primarily what we see in Daniel, the third chapter. I think Daniel, the third chapter, shows us that future rise of Christianity in an attempt to impose itself as it did in the past.
Okay. I'm reasonably certain we're all kind of heading in the same direction, and like, it's easy to get hung up on technicalities because we're Bible students, and that's just how we roll. The pastor used a specific word when it came to this thinking. We typically, at least in kind of, I'll say the study circles I've run in, we often refer to it more often than not as the hour of power. It has nothing to do with Robert Schuller's Crystal Cathedral and that TV show, which I always found quite ironic myself. But there's a word the pastor used with this sort of reconstitution of Christendom at the end of the age. And what was it? Begins with a V. Yeah, Sister Dawn. Vitalization. Or vitalization of the image. Scripturally, picture-wise, Brother Russ brought out, was it Revelation 17? These 10 kings, which are not yet, give their power for the space of an hour. Not 1260 days. So it's intended to be an extraordinarily short, compressed, condensed period of time. Other pictures. Let's think of some other things about that we have in Scripture that we routinely refer to this as this period of time, this vitalization of the image, and how it affects the church, the great multitude, or the rest.
The destruction of the three Hebrews.
Okay, the three Hebrews thrown into the fiery furnace. And they're often, what specifically happens in that case?
The cords of flesh are destroyed, so they get their change of nature.
So yeah,
John the Baptist picture.
All right, so let's get a couple of these down. So we got the three Hebrews. We often call them children. I don't really know why we do that, but I can't, because if I come away, it'll look like an EKG machine. So we've got three Hebrews. I don't know if everybody can see this. John the Baptist. What's unique about John the Baptist? Why does he point to this specific time?
The church. He points out the church-state union.
Okay. How do we know that? I mean, really. I mean, what did he do in the type? And okay, Brother Allen.
Because the Bible says so.
Okay.
Because it says that he said that what Herod did with Herodias was an illicit union.
Okay. And it's not lawful for you to have your brother's wife.
Yeah.
But how do we go from that to, well, that represents the feet members preaching against the church-state union. And we're going to be thrown in jail for preaching against it. How do we make that connection? This is much, much harder, by the way. Why do we say John the Baptist represents the feet members? Sister Karen.
Because Pastor Russell told us.
Okay. Huh? All right. Believe it or not, that's not a bad answer. You know, we've made... Think about it for a second. The great multitude. We discussed that, I think, in Alan's... I don't know if that was his first study or his second study a little bit. Not the great multitude, but the fact that that's Laodicean understanding. That's news. That's meat in due season, the understanding of the great multitude. That was not taught. You can't find that throughout church history. That wasn't even taught in the early church. Why? Why wasn't the thinking of the great multitude taught before the Laodicean stage of the church? Okay, go. Give her a mic. And elaborate, say that again and elaborate just a little bit on it.
Well, it's just not a called class. It's there. It's a mercy class, and we're thankful for it. But it's not something that, you know, it's here a little, there a little. It's not something that's clearly written.
Okay. I'm going to go one step further and really stick a fly in your brain. And say that it didn't even exist before as it's specifically mentioned. I'm not saying that there wasn't a secondary class, but it's a very specific class. And the reason this becomes important is because of the lot picture that we'll get into, because we're going to get into it because of Sodom. Sister Marge, go ahead.
I was going to basically say the same thing, that it isn't visible as a class, that it can be seen by, that we can't judge this one's great company and that one's little flock until after the little flock has gone home.
Because you're called in the
one hope.
The one hope. One Lord, one faith, one baptism, one calling. The high calling in Christ Jesus. Who else had a... Did I miss anybody? Okay. Another picture, type, even obscure, Brother Russ.
The breaking of the earthen vessels of the 300 Gideons, the Gideon's band, the 300.
Okay, and in which case the Midianites would represent the host of Midian?
Christendom.
Okay. All right, yeah, Christendom.
Use your term.
Okay, Christendom. Now, Babylon, again, we'll get back to this Babylon issue, because more things will present themselves as we go along, and so we're going to initially create a few more questions than we'll provide answers for, and maybe even, you know, kind of raise the eyebrow thing. Sister Karen, go ahead.
Well, are we looking for scriptures that show the rise of power, the second rise of power, or?
Okay, well, I'll be more specific then. We're looking for pictures, types, scriptures, you know, whatever that actually shows the condition of how this can be even referred to as Christendom at from this point, from today, May, what is it, 11th, forward. Sister Robin.
I guess I would put the Daniel in the Lion's Den picture here as well, because it was the king making some religious law that Daniel didn't follow, similar with the three Hebrews.
Okay.
And
so we can put that up there. Sister Karen.
I guess I'm not really following what you're saying, but I'll say the woman in the ephah in Zechariah 5, who we know is the false system, and how she set again on her base in Shinar.
Okay, that's actually a really good one. So that's Zechariah 5, you said? And in that picture, basically, there's a woman locked in away into a container, and these two storks pick it up and fly back to Shinar, which is Babylon, and set her back up in her place. Brother Rick.
Were you done?
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Scriptures that showed a rise of church and state to me, and kind of rattling off a little bit here, I'd add Revelation 17, verses 12 to 16. That's the hour of power that was mentioned earlier, and that these kings who had had no power reign for 1 hour and persecute and make war with the Lamb called Chosen. Then Revelation 16, verses 13 and 14, which shows that the dragon, the beast, and the false prophet all work together. And then I was thinking of Revelation 18, verses 3, 5, and 10, where the harlot says, "I am not a widow." Well, the reason she says she's not a widow is because she's united once again with these kings for 1 hour. See, if she was, she says, "I'm not a widow." See, she's married. She has a husband, but they're not husbands, really. It's these kings. So that shows a rise of power. Isaiah 23, 15 to 17, with the harlot going about the city once again, making sweet melody, and has been remembered, and she returns to her hire. And returning to the hire of a harlot is that she's united with these kings in fornication. That's the Revelation 13 picture with the vitalizing of the image, because now the Federated Protestants, the vitalized image, have the power to persecute. Well, they have no armies, they don't have a police force, so they have to be united with the civil powers if they're going to persecute. And then lastly, Jesus' parallel events to the end of his life, where Brother Russell brings out articles that it was a combination of the religious leaders pressuring the civil power to put the master to death.
Okay. All right. What Old Testament picture do we have that shows Christendom as we traditionally understand it?
Edom.
Okay, Edom, but I'm thinking something more along in Israel.
Ahab and Jezebel.
Very good, Sister Sherelle. Ahab and Jezebel. All right. That is how we view, typically anyway, the traditional Christendom, the traditional church-state union. You know, it's a marriage. You always get the sense that it's really Jezebel that's calling the shots here, and Ahab's just sort of her lackey. Another question. How much time passes between the deaths of Ahab and Jezebel? Sister Cheryl.
14 years.
14 years. 14 years passes between the time Ahab dies and Jezebel is thrown out the window at the behest of Jehu. And that'll even come into it a little bit. Actually, a lot. Now, how can we, you know, what sort of lesson, let's say, what sort of information can we garner from that quasi-hidden fact? It's not really made readily known, I'll say, in the scriptures. It's clear, you know, once you see it, you can't refute it. But the issue is that there's a fairly significant period of time between the death of Ahab and the death of Jezebel. Sister Kathy.
This is trying to recall that circumstance, but I thought that Ahab cried unto the Lord, and so he said, "I won't," you know, maybe in your children's something. There's something there. The Lord stopped his death sooner.
That was Jehoshaphat.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, he put on Ahab's clothes and he rode out and he
sorry.
Got sent in and he's like, Jehovah save me, you know. So, but Ahab was in there. That's a good, believe it or not, that's that typically factors into that whole thing, you know, the exchange. Because you have to wonder, what was in Jehoshaphat's head that made that a good idea? You know, Jehoshaphat, by the way, so you look like me to my enemy. Why don't you take my clothes and, you know, my chariot and everything and go ahead and wear that? Jehoshaphat's like, okay. You know, no. That's one of those scriptural strange mystery things. Back to my original question, which was, what's that? The 14 years, but how can we take that and use that in our thinking, our picture here of Christendom and church-state union and whatnot? Sister Karen.
If I remember correctly, it has to do with the death of, since 1914, after that is Ahaziah.
Okay. You know, in a nutshell, and I, for, at least for me, this works great. I always had a problem with Christendom and the traditional Bible student understanding on the destruction of Christendom in 1914 and World War I, but it's kind of hard to refute because the facts are pretty, you know, pretty much laid out. Christendom underwent a radical change as a result of the First World War. And right on cue in the pastor's chronology, right there, October 1914, you know, the start of hostilities. That whole thing mushroomed, and by the time it was done, Christendom was not, for lack of a better word. However, who's the main overwhelming, overarching arch-villain in Christendom?
The Pope,
the papacy, the papal system. Well, what happened to the papal system in Napoleon's day? I mean, we're talking well over a century before 1914 and World War I. Sister Bernice?
Well, he was captured by Napoleon and thrown in prison, wasn't he? And I don't remember if he died there or not, but people realized that he was not holy and infallible and that he could actually die, that he wasn't spiritual.
Okay. You know, in Revelation parlance, where is that particular incident shown in the book of Revelation? That blow to the head? Let's give the whole story away. So Revelation 13, okay. And what's that? What's it say in Revelation 13 with regard to that event?
He was wounded in the head.
Yeah, as it were unto death. Sister Bernice, go ahead.
It says in verse 3, and I saw one of his heads, as it were, wounded to death. And his deadly wound was healed, and all the world wandered after the beast.
All right. Sister Kathy.
I don't want to change your thought, but I wanted to tell you that it wasn't Jehoshaphat. I am talking about Ahab, and I wanted to read the scripture to you just because it's in 1 Kings, the 21st chapter. And it came to pass when Ahab heard those words that the Lord said, sent his prophet, that he rent his clothes, he put on sackcloth and upon his flesh, he fasted and lay in sackcloth and went softly. The word of the Lord came unto Elijah the Tishbite, saying, seest thou how Ahab humbleth himself before me? Because he humbleth himself before me, I will not bring the evil in his days, but in his son's days will I bring the evil upon the house.
Okay,
so what I was saying is that maybe that's why there's 14 years difference.
Okay. Well, I'm thinking more along the lines of when Ahab was actually killed. You know, is it treachery? Is it treachery? And the arrow and all that. And he dies from the time he actually dies, and the time Jezebel is pushed out of the window, blood, horses, dogs, all that is a 14-year period of time. And the reason we feel that that's important, which we're getting to here, is because it also harkens to this What head was the one that was wounded unto death? Sister Bernice.
The religious head.
Okay, but head number...
One? Two? I don't know.
Head number five. Head number five. Okay. What? How many heads are actually on this Revelation beast? How many heads? How many heads?
Eight.
Eight. Because why? Why are there eight heads? What makes this different? Go ahead, Sister Marge.
I beg to differ with you. It was a seven-headed beast. The eighth was not having a head. It was like a confederation of nations, but it did not have a single one as a head.
Okay.
It was a headless beast.
All right. Well, is it called the eighth head in Revelation? Okay. Let's put it this way. What is it? What is the eighth? Brother Rick, go ahead.
This aspect in Revelation 17 in verse 11. And the beast that was and is not, even he is the eighth, and is of the seven, and goeth into destruction. And there is differences of opinion on that. I'll voice my own.
Go ahead.
I believe it's a repeat of a previous head, which was a combination of church and state cooperation. So it does make it a head, but it's a repeat head in this sense.
Okay.
It's a similar form of government that had been in a previous time, but it only comes for 1 hour, very short. I know there's a reprenautical, Brother Russell talks about a headless beast. I know many fine brethren believe that, but I only have one comment about that. A headless beast is a dead beast.
Okay.
It's decapitated. And without a head, it has no government, because that's even where the horns are on the head, which demonstrate the powers. It goes back to where the crowns were in previous pictures of the 12th and 13th chapters. So I think that I understand the concept of what's being presented when that's said, but a beast without a head has no direction.
Okay. So, and that's where we're going with that particular instance. There's some time between 5 and 8 that transpires. And we think there's a direct correlation there that the 5th, in a sense, becomes the 8th. And that reflects in Revelation, that reflects in the 14 years, you know, this hiatus between Ahab and Jezebel, between 1914 and what we think is this future hour of power. They all tie in, and the pastor always referred to it as, you know, the vitalization of the image. The vitalization of the image. Why is it called an image? Anybody want to take a stab at that? Brother Mark. To be honest with you, I don't...
Well, just broadly speaking, I mean, an image is not the exact thing, but it's a representation of it. It's like it in certain ways. It maybe seeks to emulate it.
Okay.
It's not the original. It's a copy, so to speak.
Has anyone here ever seen, not necessarily been to, but seen pictures of the Lincoln Memorial? Probably everybody, just about, anyway. That's probably a pretty good image, you know, Lincoln... sitting there, you look at him, you get an idea for what he looked like. Let's call it even a photograph. We know it's not a photograph, it's not the real person, but it's, you can tell who the person is. The point being, this image is, we have a kind of an expression that he's the spitting image of his father. Brother Rick, go ahead.
Well, I thought to my mind there was an important point in the 13th chapter on this. When in verse 14, after we've already had the introduction to the ten-horned beast, then we had an introduction to the two-horned beast, in the 14th verse, and deceiveth them that dwell on the earth by the means of those miracles which he had the power to do in the sight of the beast. Now, this is talking about the two-horned beast doing these miracles in the sight of the ten-horned beast. Church of England doing these miracles in the sight of the Church of Rome, saying to them that dwell on the earth that they should make an image to the beast which had the wound by a sword and did live. So the image is an image of the papal beast, which was a combination of church and state. But it's only an image because it only has a portion of that element of being church and state.
Okay. From one perspective, it only really had control over the United Kingdom. It did not have the pervasive control that the Church of Rome had. And number two, the image looks like the original. That's the interesting thing. A lot of times we use the term Protestantism as an all-covering blanket. We need to be a little careful with that sometimes, especially when we're interpreting some complex prophecies, because we're going to take one example, Lot. Get back to Lot again. We're always coming back to Lot. He's pulled out, removed forcibly from Sodom. And, you know, we lump the two together quite frequently, Sodom and Gomorrah. What, as Bible students, is our, I'll say, traditional knee-jerk understanding of what Sodom and Gomorrah represent? Sister Dunn, it's for the record.
Papacy and Protestantism.
Okay, papacy and Protestantism, Catholicism and Protestantism. Basically the two sides of that, the Christendom coin, let's call it. However, Lot's pulled out. What little exchange happens? Where does Lot want to go? Yeah. Well, he wants to go to the city of, as Sister Kathy said, Zoar. Zoar is interesting because what does Zoar mean? Sister Karen?
Little.
Little. Sorry to make you run around so much, Brother Rick.
For one, we're going
to
get the
job. Yeah, that's all right, yeah. So I thought you could use the exercise. means little. And he even says, isn't it little? See, it's even named little. It's so small, you know, let me go there. Now, here's the thing. What do the angels say?
Okay.
Yeah, Sister Kathy. So they say, oh, well, all right, but do it now. Get there now, you know, because he doesn't, so he can't get away from city life. He doesn't want to go, because what excuse does he use? If you send me into the mountains, I'm just going to die anyway. You might as well let me die in Sodom, because if you send me into the mountains, you know, it's just going to be a prolonged death. I'm going to die anyway. So let me go into Zoar. It's just tiny. Look, they don't have the same problems. They don't have the same problems. What does this represent anything? Antitypically. Okay, compromise as a principle, but specifically, could there be any, this whole exchange, could there be any actual antitypical significance to it, Sister Karen?
Well, we see the big cities as Protestantism and Catholicism. So a little city also has to be an ism. So it could be the little non-denominational churches.
Okay. In Christianity, or Christendom, there is a panacea, literally, or let's call it a pantheon, of a whole variety that range from, we have them down here, I don't know if they exist everywhere, there's one called the Church of Christ, and they're hardcore. They're all about the Bible. They're all about non-denominationalism. They're all about autonomy. They're individual churches. In certain, from certain perspectives, they mimic the Bible student movement, except for the fact that, you know, hellfire, trinity, immortality of the soul. So, you know, mimicking ends pretty soon. But they have a firm grasp on scriptural fundamentals of what it is to, as far as the Christian hierarchy and, you know, the Christian, as a body, how we function. And their sincerity and the fact that they rely upon the scriptures, and they even say that they're in the truth. They say that. We're not the only ones. You know, there are others out there that say they're in the truth. The point being this, first off, there was another comment. Sister Sherelle, go ahead.
I was just going to mention that in this country, there's a mass exodus of people leaving the big churches for small home churches. But when we take a global perspective, In China, there's a lot of home churches, and that has some of the bigger denominations kind of worried because they have no control over them.
Yes. Yeah, and we're... thank you for accelerating us along that path. And I saw Brother Mark shaking his head here, yes, to the church. You know, I know Brother Mark's had these experiences firsthand. Sister Rachel.
There's a lot of those churches over in Athens, Alabama. It's a very... There is. They really go for that church over in Athens area.
Yeah. Can you see where we're going with this Zohar thinking? Brother Brian.
Just a quick note. There is a... the government, in their efforts to try and control, they're also looking at this as well and are looking at a way of controlling these through financial means, controlling the property that these little churches own as a way of getting them to step into line and toe the company line, so to speak. So they're looking at this problem also as a way to how are we going to control all these little splinter groups.
Okay. In this country and in many, many other countries, this rush toward globalism has inherently carries with it a mantra of conformity. I guess that's about the only way I could put it. The United Nations, there's a lot going on, and it's not entirely important for us to know all the details. I tend to get sucked into things when I start reading things. You know, I want to read more about it, and before I know it, I have to extricate myself because come to the realization that it's really not all that relevant to my consecration. This conformity and this rush toward globalism in the Western world, which has been predominantly influenced by Christianity, coincidentally. We discussed, I think, yesterday that there's currently, within the last couple of years, there's been a growing tie between Catholicism and the Church of England. The Anglican Church and the Episcopalian churches. I don't know, are they the same Anglican, Episcopalian, or is it Brother Rick? I'm sorry, go on.
Well, the Church of England is started in England.
Right.
With Henry VIII, and yet the broader worldwide application is Anglicism.
Okay.
Or the Anglican Church. And they have their different groupings around the world.
All right. Now, we know that, again, within the last couple of years, the Catholic Church has been transferring wholesale or granting wholesale Anglican bishops priesthood in the Catholic Church. I mean, it's really, to be honest with you, we have that despise not small beginnings. This is a bigger deal than it would appear on the surface. It's very muted. It's out there. I mean, it's happening. But this is actually a big deal. It's this returning aspect. Now, the reason we get back to this image, the image, is because the Anglican Church, the Church of England, and these other large denominations, but especially the Church of England, is patterned very much so after the Catholic Church. They have the same authoritarian hierarchy of, cardinals, bishops, priests, the Eucharist. They have everything except a pope. That's the only thing they lack. So it's a natural, ingress for them back to the Roman Catholic Church to say, we are them, they are us, all we need is the pope. Isn't it fortunate that they don't have a pope, so there's not going to be any conflict between them. Protestant churches don't have a pope to worry about. So these large denominations, Lutheran, Methodists, Congregationalists, the denominations that are pervasive in this country as far as the size is concerned, the biggest issue is what Brother Brian was just talking about. Brother Mark, these smaller denominations are particularly troublesome. And I think they're represented in Zohar. And if we look at this picture a little more closely, when the church is off the scene and the great multitude is removed from Sodom and by extension Gomorrah, because Sodom and Gomorrah are mentioned, they're a couplet, they're mentioned together. Just before, what's that?
Twins.
Just before that destruction, there's still a little bit of time because, remember, they're on the road, they're walking, Lot's wife is dealt with. I mean, interestingly, she's dealt with almost right off the bat. And we know what Lot's wife represents, being Bible students. They're walking on. He wants to go to Zoar. They're heading to Zoar. How close do they get to Zoar? Sister Karen.
They get right up to the edge of the city.
If they get to the gate. And they're like, wow, okay, we're here. We're at Zoar. What happens next? Sister Karen? Yeah. Boom, whatever you want to call it. Like a nuclear bomb goes off. They feel the heat and the noise, and it must have been an awesome sight when the rain, fire, and brimstone and Sodom and Gomorrah were obliterated. What does Jesus say about it? What's that?
It's going to be tolerable.
Okay, it'll be more tolerable.
For them in the kingdom.
Okay, I'm thinking more in the Matthew like 24 sense. What does he say? Advance a little bit from there. And what he uses Sodom and Gomorrah as an illustration.
If the miracles that had been done in Capernaum, is it?
Okay.
Had been done, they would be remain until this day.
All right, but I'm thinking of the reference that comes later. As it was in the days of Lot, so shall it be in the days of the Son of Man. They were eating, drinking, marrying, giving in marriage, etc., etc., until when? Okay, until the self-same day Lot and his family came out of Sodom. Until the self-same day.
Brother Brian, just for your reference on that, that's Luke 17 and verse 29.
Luke, thank you.
But the same day that Lot went out of Sodom, it rained fire and brimstone from heaven and destroyed them all.
Okay. Destroyed them all. Now we've just, as Bible students, have established through the pastor that Lot represents the great multitude. Sodom and Gomorrah represent Christendom. However, Lot is still here on the scene in the picture when that destruction happens in the flesh, let's say. So let's get to our little clothesline here. Christendom from today forward overarches almost everything until we get to the destruction of Babylon, which equates to what we're just talking about. The destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah is the destruction of Babylon. It's the destruction of Christendom, but it's not necessarily the destruction of all of Christianity. Can we make that distinction? Does that sound reasonable? Is there a better way to put that for clarity's sake?
Could you just repeat what you said?
Okay.
Please?
The destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah and the destruction of Babylon is the destruction of Christendom, but it's not necessarily the destruction of Christianity or all Christian denominations.
One thing that might support that is in Genesis 21, excuse me, and that's when he requested to go to Zoar. He said to him, "Behold, I grant you this request also, not to overthrow the town of which you have spoken."
Not to what?
Not to overthrow the town of which you have spoken.
Okay. All right. So we're stretching things a little bit because I'll say they're generally not addressed, these particular points that are in these pictures. So we have to address Zoar, that it still exists after the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, and the exchange that he's so emphatic about, the little, it's just so tiny, it's even named tiny, you know, let us go there, and finally gets permission to do so, and that it's not destroyed. So from this point forward, have the kings given their power over for an hour today? Right now. Has that happened? Okay. The two people I'm looking at, three, shaking no. The rest are like, whoop. So no, we're going to say that that's a future event. Who are these 10 kings that are not yet? Sister Karen.
If they're not yet, how do we know?
Yeah. If they're not yet, how do we know who they are? Okay. Brother Russ.
I guess first the word kings, it is kind of a generic word, you know, like it can be mighty ones, it can be loosely interpreted. I've heard the thought, and so far it sounds appealing to me, that at some point in time you'll have the papal nuncios, that it will be granted power in various areas. And you don't hear much about the papal nuncios. The pope will come, you know, to visit a country, mm-hmm. and where does he stay? He stays with the papal nuncio. So it may have to do with, the papal nuncios in Europe.
Okay. Back to this thing here, this vitalization of the image. Has the image been vitalized yet? And what is vitalization? Let's start first. What is vitalization? Sister Karen?
Well, as everyone said, it's giving it life.
Giving it life. Okay. What is the image again?
The image before it's vitalized, we think it came into being as the Evangelical Alliance,
okay.
which was a religion, was a religious organization, but had no civil power. A beast needs to be a combination of a civil power and the religious organization. This is only an image because it's only one part of that.
All right. Who's got the scripture that brings out the making and like setting up of this image?
When you say the setting up, are you thinking of the Daniel 3rd, the gold image?
I want Revelation 13. First, and then we'll go back to Daniel. Because we've already mentioned the three Hebrews right up top there and everything, so we will get into that. But where's the Revelation scripture that talks about the image being set up? What's that? Okay, so read the whole context, Sister Diane.
Okay, I'll start with the 14th verse. And deceiveth them that dwell on the earth by the means of those miracles which he had power to do in the sight of the beast, saying to them that dwell on the earth that they should make an image to the beast which had the wound by a sword and did live. And he had power to give life unto the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause that as many as would not worship the image of the beast should be killed.
Okay. Now, can you hold on to that mic for a second? Who issues the command? Who makes the image?
Well, who issues the command is...
You can read it again. That's fine.
Saying to them that dwell on the earth.
Who is saying to them that dwell on the earth?
The beast.
Okay, the beast.
Is saying to them that dwell on the earth that they should make an image to the beast.
Okay. All right. Brother Rick?
Well, normally when we say the beast, we think of the ten-horned beast papacy.
Right.
But I think the one here in this verse is the two-horned beast. So by the example of what Henry VIII did and got away with, at a later date, these Protestants got together to form the Evangelical Alliance that was an image to the very first beast, papacy, just to be a powerful religious organization because they were trying to counteract the influence of William Miller and the disappointment of the Millerite movement. With the delayed expectation of Jesus' return, and they thought, we've got to put an end to this. We have to have an organized platform of Christian doctrinal beliefs, of which part was the Trinity and Hellfire. And outside of that, you're really outside of Christian orthodoxy.
Okay. Let's give the mic back to Sister Diane. we really want to approach this, that from what the scripture we're reading, that we're going to take that scripture and we're going to put it beyond today. Go ahead and just read it again, so we've all got the both of them.
Both of them.
Yeah, nice and slow for the we who are very slow.
Okay, and deceiveth them that dwell on the earth by the means of those miracles which he had power to do in the sight of the beast, saying to them that dwell on the earth that they should make an image to the beast, which had the wound by a sword and did live. And he had power to give life unto the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause that as many as would not worship the image of the beast should be killed.
Okay. Can you go on this? And it goes further with the mark and everything, right? Go ahead.
And he causeth all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark in their right hand or in their foreheads, and that no man might buy or sell, save he that had the mark, or the name of the beast, or the number of his name. Here is wisdom. Let him that hath understanding count the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and his number is 666.
Okay. So first off, we think mark of the beast. That's just one thing, because we're told, receive the mark, or what? Name, receive his name, or what? Or the number. So there are going to be multiple ways. You know, of course, we know there are Christians out there thinking that social security numbers are the mark of the beast, and there's some beast computer in Europe somewhere, and you know, we've got all these kind of kooky conspiracy theories. But the point is that they're going to be, it's more than just any one thing, because we're told that they get the power to deceive like everybody. And to control everybody, you know, rich and poor, doesn't matter. So today, from this point moving forward, something fairly catastrophic has to happen in order for that kind of power to, if right now in the situation that exists today, if anything, things are heading in the other direction with atheism and agnosticism and the, you know, in both Europe and in the United States. So the direction that things are heading in right now seems to be antithetical to a premise that we're talking about, having a church-state union that we're going to have to speak out against and we're going to be killed because of. So what happens now in this Revelation picture, it shows that there are multiple ways that this can occur. It doesn't always have to be the same. Gideon. How many people did Gideon battle the Midianites with? It's kind of a trick question, but it's okay. No, you can. Yeah, Sister Bernice, go ahead.
300.
Okay, it was 300, but there's a subtle nuance in there that becomes very important. How many was it? In I'll say what fashion? Go ahead, Brother Allen.
Well, after the 300 flew the horns, the other 9,700 joined them, so there was 10,001.
Okay, there's 10,001, but Sister Karen, and unfortunately Karen is married to me, so she gets to hear me spout off.
Are you meaning, because I was a little distracted, three bands of 100?
Three bands of 100. Why is that important? Why are we given that detail? He just didn't go down with 100. It's very specific. It's three bands of 100, Sister Karen.
Because that ties in with the three Hebrews and a lot of
Noah and his three sons
and a lot of different pictures.
Okay. Three wise men. So we've got a number of pictures where it makes a distinction. It breaks up. A number of theories have been postulated. I shouldn't say a number, but certain theories have been postulated as to why this is. Here we have three ways, ironically, that the beast can exert its control, that they're, you know, only the ones that don't receive his name or his number or his mark, none of the above, are the ones that are put to death, we're going to say the indication seems to be, how can that system wield global control? Because, to be frank, who in China, who in India, who in the Middle East and a variety of other places cares about Christianity? Let's ask this question. How many Christians are on this planet right now? And I'm being, in the most generous term, Christians. How many people live on this planet today? 7 billion. It's an interesting number, but regardless. 7 billion people are on this planet. I remember back in the 80s, it was a big deal when we hit 4 billion. No, that was in the 80s, and now we've almost doubled. 7 billion people. Only 2 billion have anything to do with Christianity. And that's Catholicism and Protestantism combined. That leaves 5 billion people, the vast majority, essentially not subject to what we're talking about here. Any thoughts on that in relation to this, perhaps this division of threes here? Yeah, I didn't think there would be. Well, Brother Russ, what's the understanding we've kind of been reared with regard to this three bands of 100?
Well, of course, there were also the three disciples that were closest to the Lord. So yeah. I think, to me, it's rather convincing evidence this is speaking to the little flock.
Okay.
And in some manner, they're broken up geographically or
situationally, some way. There's a distinction even amongst the little flock as to what their Brother Rick.
Well, just along that line, we think there's those who are in the mainly Protestant-influenced world, those that are mainly in the Roman Catholic-influenced world, and those that are in the heathen world, our brethren like in India and some of these other African countries, whether it's tribal, Myanmar, which is Buddhist, Japan, Shintoism, and so that would be like that heathen world, but some countries are more predominantly under the Roman Catholic influence rather than the Protestant. So there's a three-division possibility.
Okay, so we're not saying that they're reared up as little flock members in these systems, only that the dominant, let's say, religious aspect or control factor is different. So we can't expect someone in a country who's not going through, you know, a brother or a sister in a country who has, you know, there's not going to be a church-state union there because, you know, it doesn't exist for there to be one. For them to go through the same, like, John the Baptist, Herod, Herodias type situation. So this, what we're discussing now with regard to Christendom has to be centered in ostensibly the Western world, and ideally, I'll say, it really has to be centered in where was the original Christendom located?
Rome.
Okay, a little more geographically speaking. Europe. All right. Sorry for the parochial questions here, but Europe is where the original Christendom was located. Did that Christendom exert, any influence ostensibly over here in this country? Was the United States part of Christendom? Up until 1914? Okay, I see no and yes. I'd like to find out with Sister Sherelle shaking her head yes. I'd like to find out what she's thinking. And in what sense was the United States part of the original Christendom?
Let me find the reference in the volume.
Okay, all right. While you're finding the reference, Brother Rick, do you have?
Well, I was just going to say, if we're going back to the earlier, you know, definition of Christendom as countries that are predominantly Christian, the United States certainly was. The founding fathers were Christian, and they came from Europe, and they came over with their denominations. They didn't come over here and suddenly start a new denomination right off the bat. Things developed over time, so there's an element.
Okay, Sister Diane, or Sister Robin first, actually, and then Sister Diane.
Well, again, and if we're defining it as the religious has influence over the civil, then no, United States wasn't, because there was a separation of church and state.
Okay. That's an important point. Sister Diane?
It's interesting to note, in just looking at the census of Christians in the world today. The United States still has the largest Christian population. And of the world, Christianity represents 33% of the population. And then also an interesting fact is that of that, the Anglican faith is only 1.2%.
Yeah, very good. But still, so 33% means 67% are represented not by Christianity. Brother Brian.
And I don't want to get overly technical, and there's no reason to dwell on the details, but there's an aspect of this that would negate that as well, because the United States was controlled at a very early stage by European financiers and bankers. So there was still that element of an underlying control, whether you call it church-state union or whatever, because they could trace that all the way back to the Vatican, you know, if you wanted. So was it really, you know, a separation of powers? Not really. So it could get pulled in that way.
Okay. I would almost go so far as, and I know Sister Sherelle is still looking, but I'm gonna say myself that the United States was not part of Christendom for a couple of reasons. One, working a little bit backward, the pastor, the Laodicean messenger. I don't think that it's any coincidence that message came out of this country. I'm not saying the country is the important point. I'm saying the atmosphere and the conditions that were ripe for the expansion and growth of the seventh message, there was no other place on the planet that it really could have come out. The separation of church and state, the fact that many of our founding fathers in reality were what are called deists. I don't know if you're familiar with the difference between a deist and a theist. We're all theists. A deist says, yeah, you know, this is before evolution and all that, and who knows if they would have remained deists, but, you know, it had to come from somewhere. Somebody had to create it. But, you know, all these religions and, you know, fairy tales and all that kind of stuff, that's just an invention of man. That's the way the deist looks at it. Yeah, there's probably a God out there, but, you know, he's long since moved on from making the earth. Our founding fathers were, by and large, you know, at least probably 50% of them anyway, were of that persuasion, were of the deist persuasion. Many certainly were Christian, there's no doubt about it. The point being that while their Christian sensibilities and thinking entered into their actions and what happened in this country, it wasn't done at the behest of a church. There was no state-sponsored religion. In fact, the United States was anti-Catholic. They were very much against the papacy. Pope and papist was a bad word in this country for well over a century. So we're only approaching this from a religious perspective. And the reason we're bringing up that aspect is because if the old Christendom was a Eurocentric thing, I think by extrapolation we can presume that the new Christendom is likewise going to be like a Eurocentric thing. I mean, it's coming out of the same place. Just out of curiosity, when did the Vatican become an independent city-state? Sister Karen.
Wasn't it 1929 with the Vatican Concordant?
Yeah, it was in 1929 or 1924. I always get those two messed up. But anyway, it was in the 1920s. The pastor was off the scene. It seemed like the kings had had their day, and everything was new. It was all shiny and new, and it was like a new era, in a sense. Now, isn't it interesting that this independent city-state, this Vatican, is a member of the United Nations? Has embassies in virtually every country around the globe. As far as an influence is concerned, they're actually their influence is spread more pervasively throughout the world, but it's in almost, I'll say, like a clandestine sense. So this idea of Christendom is related directly to Babylon the Great, mother of harlots. She's going to be the ringleader, because all of these churches that rejoin again, starting with, you know, the images, they're going to, like, I'll say, like buttress You know, we have the thinking of the scrolls that roll together, and they're not quite together, but they are together kind of thing. It almost doesn't matter because, in point of fact, it's not a, you know, it's not critical to our thinking of Christendom as an overarching principle. But it all starts with this thinking, what the pastor called the vitalization of the image. Sister Sherelle, have you found your... Okay, can you paraphrase? Can you kind of remember what it was?
I thought it was in the fourth volume where he included the United States under Babylon.
Okay.
The city and country.
Okay.
But I didn't find it, so maybe it's not that way.
All right. Well, again, I think that's why we want to be specific with our applications of the term like Babylon. We can say the spirit of Babylon, and I think there's no doubt that the daughter systems are essentially, you can run that whole term across the entire panacea of Christian denominations, simply because of the baggage that they took out. When they took Trinity, Hellfire, Immortality of the Soul, you know, they got rid of the you know, what was, I think, seven primary objections, you know, with regard to the Eucharist and the priesthood and the saints and all that. Okay, vitalization of the image. Has or has that not happened? Has the image been vitalized? Brother Rick.
I'm going to ask you to just clarify. I guess I'm still not understanding what your concept of the image is. So I'm not a strict timekeeper, but you got 5 minutes for this session,
okay.
And unfortunately you don't pick up till tomorrow.
Oh, yeah.
So
well, that's true too.
We're all happy, right, well, to hear what your thoughts are.
Okay. All right. If it's a process, it's begun. It's already begun, if it's a process. If it's something that's meant to be, like when it actually, like Frankenstein, he builds the body, everything's there, he's got all the parts in place, but what vitalizes Frankenstein? The electricity, the lightning that comes down into him. And then Frankenstein, it's alive. So it depends upon, Frankenstein is being built right now. He's on the table, and I should say, for clarification purposes, it's really Dr. Frankenstein is building his monster, which isn't Frankenstein, but that doesn't matter. So it's in the process right now, and we've brought out a couple of things that are hidden generally from general public view, and with the Anglican Church and the Vatican getting back into bed together, with this clear push. Now, why is there a big push right now, even on behalf of a number of Protestant denominations, to like reunify or get closer to the Catholic Church? There's an overriding fear here. I'm sorry, Brother Russ, you were going to say.
Well, at first, for myself, I...
Thank you, Brother Rick. I'm keeping a close eye on this matter of the personal ordinariate. Because I do think that fits much, much tighter to the scripture picture than the Evangelical Alliance. And it's a new development, 2011. It's in effect a mirror copy of papacy, and the Pope is the one who has given power to it,
mm-hmm.
You know, in a very direct sense. Benedict is the one who started this, and it's growing. It's getting momentum. The, I think one of the reasons that there's more, finances, I think, is one of the underlying concerns that many churches are facing right now, Catholic Church and Protestant churches. So I think consolidating their finances can be one of the motivating factors. Beyond that, I'm not quite sure what answer you're looking for.
Okay, well, not a specific answer necessarily. Sister Sherelle, she's located something.
Just for the record, since I finally found the reference, it's on the fourth volume, page 36, where he starts out by saying, "Let it be borne in mind then that in the great political ecclesiastical systems which men call Christendom but which God calls Babylon," and then he goes on until he finally ends it. I won't read it because I don't have a voice. That okay.
hope I put my glasses on. We have not only the foundation, but also the superstructure and the crowning pinnacle of the present social order. This is implied in the generally accepted term Christendom, which of late is applied not only to those nations which support Christian sects by legislation and taxation, but also to all nations which show tolerance to Christianity without in any definite manner favoring or supporting it, as, for instance, these United States.
Okay. Yeah, and I'll say in spirit, yes. In from technical, you know, technicality, no. Does that make sense? Yeah. That because, you know, we have, like, Christian roots, Christian affiliation, and I'll say most of our founding fathers and those that came before them leading up to the independence of this nation were trying to get away from Europe. They wanted out. They didn't want to be under, you know, the European yoke. And that was even from a, you know, freedom of religion was a big reason why many of the founding fathers came over here. So now I'm not saying that we won't be included in that later on. I very much think we will, as far as a country is, you know, being concerned, because Brother Rick, and I know Brother Mark is up on this as well. Dominionism in this country is a force to be reckoned with. It really is. And it comes in no stronger form than from the evangelical leaders. Evangelical Christians are really pushing for this, and dominionism is what Brother Rick was saying. They want control of this country, and bring it back, as it were, to our Christian roots. And on top of that, there's actually a bill in North Carolina right now that wants to assign a state religion in North Carolina. So, Brother Brian, I wish I saw these earlier. I didn't see these.
So in tying that, what you just said, into our present discussion, it's like the third-party syndrome. You know, Protestants and the Catholics, they've been fighting for years for power, apostolic succession, and whose right is it and all that. I think they're scared of dominionists. They see this coming up, and they know that if they stay separated, they'll never accomplish what needs to be accomplished. But if they join together, they have a chance. So I think that's what's helping to draw them back together. And it's all compromise. There's nothing but compromise, and they've got to sort it out, or they're going to lose completely.
The enemy of my enemy is my friend. And the whole reason for Protestantism has evaporated. That doesn't exist anymore in modern-day Christianity, churchianity. So, at any rate, we should have... I didn't see these back there. I'm glad they're there. I wouldn't have written vitalization. Just real quick, I'm going to throw these up here. We'll end. We'll pick this back up tomorrow. We didn't make any traction today. I didn't honestly expect us to, because we wanted to throw a bunch of stuff out there. Tomorrow we'll separate it and make a little bit more heads or tails out of it, especially as far as our timeline is concerned. We're just going to put these up in a semi order. Okay. Might be a little fluctuation in there, a little bit. Vitalization of the image. Say ye not a confederacy. Church, state, union, hour of power. Elisha smiting Jordan / John the Baptist message. The dark night, or the night cometh wherein no man can work. Issuing the mark of the beast. Should probably be marking by the beast or mark of the beast. And the not receiving it, John the Baptist in prison beheaded. Probably all kind of as a result of this message, but it'll be the dark night. So, And there are probably some other things. I'm not sure what Elisha receiving cloak is. Oh, and then, of course, pouring of the plagues. Where is that? Pouring of plagues. Great tribulation.
Brother Brendan, who pours the plagues if the John the Baptist is imprisoned and beheaded?
Who pours the plagues if the John the Baptist is in, let me see, pouring a plague before Great Tribulation, completion of church, in prison. Oh, okay, yeah, well, see, he's in prison for a while before he's beheaded. Okay. Yeah.
We just want you to enjoy what Brother Alan and Larry and I enjoyed.
Yeah. let's see. Then we've got loosing of four winds in here somewhere as well. Where's the destruction of Babylon? Where'd that go? Here we are. Okay. And this is somewhere. Not too sure about that one. Okay. What do you think? Sister Robin.
It's now under John the Baptist's message, but you had Elisha smiting. I think you had Elijah.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. You're right. Thanks for catching that, like Brother Alan said. Okay. Here we go. And, of course... Okay, so, and we're dealing strictly with Christendom, so destruction of civil power is irrelevant to Christendom. That comes later, after the destruction of Babylon. What do you think? Loosing of four winds before, in part and parcel with Great Tribulation, then destruction of Babylon, or something like that? What do you think, Brother Rick? Brother Alan? Brother Russ? For the rest,
I wanted to say before, but sort of concurrent. I mean, of course, this gets to even another complex subject of, you know, with regard to Satan and the fallen angels. You know, the Apostle Paul saying, "Though an angel come from heaven, if he preach another mm-hmm. gospel than which we have preached, believe it not." So, I think initially, much of the evangelical world will eat that right up when the adversary comes as our Lord at His second advent, and at first that whole atmosphere will be one that's, I'll say, more tolerant, but then over the course of time the true colors are displayed and the adversary and his fallen host will usurp authority over mankind, and things will change. So that's why I think the four winds are sort of tied into the initial acceptance by the Christian world, but then subsequently its destruction.
Okay. So, kind of more a little like this? Okay. Alright. Image first, confederation, which is probably concomitant with the image. Hour of power, that's all in there. That's really, I'm going to say, the hour of power and the Confederacy are more or less synonymous. Is that what you would say? Is there... Brother Rick?
I think it's right there.
Okay.
Yeah, it's
okay.
Right there.
All right. Elijah smiting Jordan, John the Baptist message, are those synonymous? Sister Robin?
No, actually, the previous point, I think yesterday we said the Confederacy was the Protestantism and Catholicism Confederacy, not
Federated
the Church
Protestantism or
state.
Whatever. Okay.
So preceding it the way it is a little better.
Like this. Okay. So the Confederacy will lead to the hour of power. Church, state, union. Okay. John the Baptist smiting message synonymous. Is that, is there any... Okay, kind of. Dark night wherein no man can work. And of course, at this point, We don't have. Do we have? Oh, here we are. Complete. Oh wait, why do I have that completion of church there? Well, kind of. Well, it needs to be bigger, like Brother Alan was saying. I guess that's kind of the same. We got to kind of keep that the way it is, I suppose. Okay, pouring of the plagues.
In my mind, I equate that further back because I think it's a message of the church, but it would be further
back. Yeah, I've got church up here.
But back with Elijah smiting Jordan and John the Baptist, I think that kind of relates because if you have a dark night set in, they won't be able to give a final message of final plague.
So about here then. So completion of the church, John the Baptist beheaded, imprisoned, beheaded. Okay, dark night because of pouring plagues. They don't receive the mark of the beast. That's probably somewhere in that dark night thing. Is that an appropriate characterization? Okay. Great tribulation. That's also kind of dark night, blah, blah, blah. Loosing of four winds. We've got Armageddon here somewhere. Destruction of Babylon. Have we undone anything that's been done? I mean, are we kind of... Brother Alan?
I reserve my comment till tomorrow.
Okay. All right.
Brother Brennan, that probably might be true. We're 10 after 6.
Okay, yeah. Sorry about that. Okay.
We just do get more time tomorrow.
Yeah. Play that. We'll stick with that line for anyone who's interested in... And then we'll try to justify it tomorrow. So, sorry for going over.
Thank you, Brother Brendan. We very much appreciate that, and we do look forward to tomorrow's study. We do look forward to more about the image and what it is, and it seemed like some things were being developed along that line.